This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening, Africa. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Jason Patinkin, and here's what's coming up.
We condemn recent violence and loss of life in Chad. We support a peaceful and democratic transition of power to a civilian-led government.
That's the U.S. State Department spokesman on developments in Chad. Plus, an avian flu virus threatens South Africa's poultry industry. These stories and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. We start in Chad, where the FACT rebel group in the north has vowed to overthrow the son of the country's late president after he was named leader of a newly organized military council in charge of the country. The rebels say they are pausing their advance until after late President Idriss Deby Itno's funeral. The international community is closely watching the situation in Chad. That includes both the U.S. and France, who had been close partners of the late president in the fight against extremism in the region. VOA's Mohamed El-Shanawi has more.
The Rebel Front of Change and Concord in Chad, known as FACT, has condemned the military's decision to name Mohamed Idriss Deby the new president and the head of a new ruling military council. Deby, a 37-year-old army general, is the son of President Idriss Deby Itno, who died of combat wounds on Tuesday. In response, the rebels have vowed to continue their march toward the capital N'Djamena and have warned foreign officials not to attend Friday's funeral of President Idriss Deby for security reasons. French President Emmanuel Macron is among the dignitaries expected at the funeral. The younger Deby says there will be a 18-month transition period before there are elections, a move the opposition and the rebels say ignores the Constitution's rules for presidential succession. William Lawrence, a professor of political science at the American University in Washington, says what happened in Chad amounts to a soft coup.
When the son of a military head of state, who's also in the military, says, I'm going to be running the country for 18 months. It's definitely in violation of the Chadian constitution that the Speaker of the House is supposed to take over. Technically, it's a coup. It's nonviolent, but it's extra constitutional.
Chad's National Assembly President Haroun Kabadi said Wednesday that he supported the decision to bypass him and appoint the military council to lead the transition. French Foreign Minister today told France to television that Kabadi's statement appeared to justify the military taking over. He also said Paris remains concerned about stability in Chad. U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price did not comment on the move to bypass the Constitution's rule for presidential succession. He did say the U.S. is standing with the people of Chad.
We condemn recent violence and loss of life in Chad. We support a peaceful and democratic transition of power to a civilian-led government. Obviously, developments in recent days and hours are a cause for concern, but we will continue to call for and support a peaceful, democratic transition to a civilian-led government.
Price also has said the U.S. is closely watching the situation in Chad, which he described as fluid. Experts say there is a great deal of uncertainty around how events in Chad will unfold, including whether the army will stay loyal to Deby's son and continue the effort to repel the advancing rebels. The late president has been a key partner in the G5 Sahel group, which cooperates to fight extremist militants across Burkina Faso, Mali, Mauritania, Niger, and Chad. The U.S., France, and other Western allies back the G5 Sahel, and France has several thousand troops in Chad. Human Rights Watch said Wednesday that foreign states backed Deby's government for its support for counter-terrorism operations and other regional initiatives, but largely ignored his legacy of repression and violations of social and economic rights. Mohamed El-Shanawi, VOA News, Washington.
Meanwhile, cracks are emerging among Chad's military leadership. Debbie's son, General Mohamed Idris Debbie, said yesterday that the army wanted to return power to a civilian government and hold free elections in 18 months. But not everyone supports his military council. Another general, Idris Mohamed Abderrahmane Diko, told VOA's French language service on Wednesday that he represents a faction of the army opposed to the military takeover. It was not clear how many soldiers were under Diko's command, but he accused, quote, a small circle of military friends, end quote, of appointing Debbie's son to power in what he termed a coup. Diko called on the new military council to sit with civil society and trade unions for dialogue toward a transition to free elections. Separately, Chadian opposition member Yassine Abderrahmane Sakine of the Reformist Party accused the army and France of backing a coup to install Debbie's son. For more on the situation in Chad, I reached out to Richard Moncrief in Nairobi. Moncrief leads the International Crisis Group's Central Africa Research Program. Richard, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, no problem.
So first of all, Richard, what's the state of play with the rebels?
Well, the current state of play, as I understand, is that the rebels contested the legitimacy of the military committee that has replaced President Debbie. So that is fraught with risk because this is a significant, well-armed rebel group with a significant rear base in Libya. It also, I would add, raises the question, a very important question, of whether this rebel group, called the FACT, may be able to bring on board other rebel groups based in Libya and whether they may join it or launch complementary attacks in other parts of the country. And that is a very critical question for Chad at the moment.
And what about Chad's military? Not only did they lose their president, but also numerous other generals were said to be killed as well. Is there any indication of the army's ability to stop the rebel advance?
Well, they did push it back, of course, just a few days ago and repelled the rebels who retreated back up north, did what they called themselves a strategic retreat. Now, how to the degree to which they were weakened in that fight, you rightly say that a number of high-ranking officers were killed, and no doubt that's true, but so were the rebels. So in a way, we are as we were. The second question in there is, of course, they've lost their commander-in-chief. And a very important question at the moment is whether the new military committee that's taken over the country has full ability to deploy soldiers and command the army, and that will play out in the coming days and weeks.
Now let's look at the new government, which is a military council. There are questions of whether the council was established according to the constitution, and also questions of whether the Chadian people in N'Djamena or beyond will support the council. Can you go into that?
The constitution is slightly difficult to follow because it was changed in 2018 to provide for a vice president who would take over in this current circumstances, but that vice president hasn't been named. The previous constitution stipulated that the head of the National Assembly should take over. So there's a little bit of ambiguity there, but I think that most observers are fairly clear that this is not a constitutional regime at the moment. The second point on the streets of N'Djamena, if we go by the statements of most political parties, opposition political parties and civil society, they are very much opposed to what they see as continuity with a highly militarized government under President Debbie. It's very likely that the vast majority of people in N'Djamena see things the same way. They don't want to be ruled by the military, and they do see that as a continuity with the previous regime, under which they've been certainly impoverished and also protesting, including at the very recent election. So the military committee is there in power, led by Debbie's son, but I think it's going to find itself very contested, both internally in Chad and possibly also by external actors.
And staying on Chad's army, it's been involved in many military fronts besides the rebels in the north. What impact does the rebel advance have on those military operations?
Even before the death of President Debbie, the rebellion that had entered Chad from Libya on the 11th of April already posed the question of the overstretch of the Chadian army, which is deployed far from Chad in the Sahel, is also deployed on the Lake Chad Basin against Boko Haram and its component parts, also deployed on the eastern border where Darfur continues to be unstable, and deployed in the south where there is a great instability in the Central African Republic. So you can see immediately that it's the army's overstretched. Then there's an attack on the 11th of April by a very large column of rebels coming from Libya. And now the death of the president, who wasn't only the president, but was the commander-in-chief and took that role as head of the army very, very seriously. So I think there are a whole series of questions about the sustainability of Chad's operations on its borders and further afield.
That was Richard Moncrief with the International Crisis Group speaking to me from Nairobi. Richard, thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Separately, Nigeria's defense minister said Thursday his country had beefed up border security to avoid an influx of Chadians in the aftermath of President Debi's death. The U.S. State Department says it has seen no evidence that Eritrean troops are withdrawing from the northern Tigray region of Ethiopia. State Department spokesman Ned Price yesterday called for Eritrea's, quote, immediate full withdrawal, as we believe it is critical to restoring peace and security and critical to that issue of humanitarian access, end quote. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said Eritrean troops would withdraw nearly a month ago. The U.S. cited a, quote, growing number of credible reports of atrocities and human rights violations and abuses, end quote. Many of those allegations, including of sexual violence, have been leveled at Eritrean soldiers who entered the region in support of Abiy's forces last year. Ethiopian officials have variously denied and admitted allegations leveled against their forces. Eritrea has not admitted any atrocities, but says perpetrators of sexual violence should be harshly punished. Separately, yesterday in Tigray, the international medical charity Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, said that for 12 days, the road linking to the major city of Aksum in Tigray has been blocked, hampering life-saving medical services at hospitals there. Also in Ethiopia, the state-appointed Ethiopian Human Rights Commission said an armed group had taken control of a district in the country's Benishangul-Gumuz region in the west. It said civilians were reportedly killed and public servants kidnapped in Sedal Wereda, which is home to 25,000 people. Now in South Africa, the poultry industry is under threat following an outbreak of avian influenza. The H5 strain was detected at a Johannesburg farm last week, forcing the farmer to cull 300 chickens. Although experts say H5 poses no risk to human health, South Africa's neighbors have started banning imports of its poultry products. Industry players say that could batter the poultry industry. Tuso Kamalo reports from Johannesburg.
The outbreak at the farm east of Johannesburg has left the government and poultry farmers extremely worried. Mpo Maya is the director of animal health at the Department of Agriculture, Land Reform and Rural Development.
Botswana has suspended trade completely. We are negotiating with them the information that we've requested. Namibia has suspended trade from the infected property. Lesotho has suspended trade from Gauteng as a province. And we are still in discussions with Eswatini and Mozambique and other SADC countries.
Colin Stenhissen from the South African Poultry Association says the impact will be huge.
Botswana imports fertile hatchery eggs. Mozambique imported 12,845 tons of broiler meat in 2020 and 10,608 tons of normal table eggs, eggs that you and I would eat. Included in that would be a few hundred tons of fertile eggs as well.
South Africa exported poultry products worth over $70 million in 2019. Maya adds that the economy will not be spared if more countries decide to impose bans.
We are the biggest producers, both of table eggs and of your normal broilers. So it hits us hard because the region relies on us for those products.
However, Stenhassen says there is no need to panic.
There is no need to be concerned about a shortage of either broiler or eggs at this point in time. We are hoping that the disease has been contained to where it is at the moment, and we are hoping and praying that it doesn't spread further than where it is or where it has already been found.
The H5 strain is largely spread by migratory birds and is very pathogenic in fowls. In 2017, South Africa culled 4.7 million chickens, causing a serious egg shortage nationwide due to an outbreak of the highly infectious H5N8 bird flu. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
International affairs analysts say Russia's interest in Africa continues to grow, with the Kremlin establishing footholds in several areas on the continent in recent years. But as Russia's presence in Africa swells, so too do concerns by many organizations, including human rights groups, about Moscow's objectives and the methods it might use to achieve them. Darren Taylor has more.
Moscow's strong ties with Africa go back to the days of colonialism, when the Soviet Union supported African liberation movements with weapons, military training, and cash. But after the Cold War ended and the Soviet Union melted, Moscow largely withdrew from the continent. Those observing the Kremlin's foreign policy in Africa say the first clear signal that Russia's back on the continent in a big way was the Russia-Africa summit in Sochi in 2019, that drew leaders from 50 African countries. Moscow then launched a Russia-Africa secretariat.
Also, the deputy minister, Mikhail Bogdanov, has announced that Africa is one of the priorities of Russian policy now.
Jvinka Kachur is a political researcher watching Russia's resurgence in Africa for Stellenbosch University. She says Moscow's representatives are now meeting regularly with African Union leaders.
The anti-West narrative is very strong, and Russia is trying to find allies in fighting the Western sanctions. At the same time, Russia is offering to African countries support in the UN dialogue, so in the global dialogue, where Russia has still strong representation. It supports the restructuring of the UN system to allow for more equal inclusion of African countries.
Kachur says Russia's promoting nuclear power across the continent, but seems particularly interested in military cooperation.
Zimbabwe and Mozambique have Russian Kalashnikov assault rifle, AK-47, at their coats of arms. Africa is one of the major importers of Russian arms.
She says the Kremlin's also seeking a strong presence in Africa's information space. For pro-democracy groups, this is very concerning, given Moscow's apparent involvement in cybersecurity breaches in the United States. Kachur says Russia seems particularly interested in Mozambique, where rich mineral deposits have been found relatively recently.
In Mozambique, Soviet Union supported Frelimo, the party that still remains in power. Russian specialists have been working in Mozambique since independence. So on the day of independence, diplomatic relationships were established between Mozambique and Soviet Union, and Russian experts were working in defense, health, and public service.
She says she also sees a stronger Russian presence in Zimbabwe. Moscow was a strong supporter of former President Robert Mugabe and continues to lobby vociferously for an end to sanctions against the southern African nation. Kachur points out that the Russian government has been very strategic since the days of colonialism by sponsoring the education of especially the sons of elites in Mozambique and Zimbabwe.
Presently, 71 scholarships are provided to Zimbabwean students and about 30 to Mozambican students. So this creates a number of politicians, businessmen, as well as other influential people in Mozambique and Zimbabwe that understand Russian mentality, often speak the language, and are very willing to collaborate and cooperate.
The analyst is convinced that one factor sparking Moscow's renewed drive into Africa is Washington-led sanctions imposed following Russian aggression against Ukraine in 2014.
Since Russian sanctions, according to Duma, Russian parliament, Africa is the only region in the world that consistently increases imports from Russia. The other factor is the drop in oil prices that forces Vladimir Putin's administration to look for new areas for revenues.
Kashour says the longer the sanctions hold, the more the Kremlin will seek to solidify its influence in Africa. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Today is Earth Day. Of special concern this year are the world's oceans, which are threatened, according to experts, by pollution, by human-caused climate change, as well as industrial overfishing. And that includes fishing for species that are ground into powder used to feed farmed fish. And many of those fishmeal plants are in West Africa. For more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Ian Urbina, who is the founder of the Outlaw Ocean Project, a nonprofit journalism organization which reports on human rights, labor, and ocean environmentalism.
In terms of the abuse when it comes to the marine environment, you have more than 80% of the world's fish stocks are at or beyond the point of collapse. They've been overfished. You also have a rampant problem of illegal fishing. So the state of affairs at sea are pretty bleak.
One major strategy that environmentalists talk about is to raise fish in farms on land or in pens close by the shore.
That's quite right. The problem there is that sort of fishing requires you to feed the fish, to fatten them up faster, get them to market. And so historically, to feed those fish in high protein fashion relied on soy. But in the last couple decades, we've shifted to grinding up fish into these pellets and powder called fish meal to feed to the other fish in the fish farms, which makes no sense because it's now accelerating the worsening of the problem that they were trying to solve, which is ocean depletion. And so you might have 1 pound of tuna equating to 25 pounds of wild caught forage fish. So you're collapsing the food chain, essentially.
What sorts of fish do they use for fish meal?
The fish that end up as fish meal tend to be called forage fish or trash fish that tend to be smaller fish that are not economically viable to sell, but they're essential for the food chain within the marine environment.
And ultimately, the break in that chain means fewer large fish for humans to eat at the apex of the system.
It means less food for us. It also means the oceans die. If the seas run out of marine life, the oceans stop serving a key purpose. I mean, the ocean produces 50% of the air we breathe. It's a huge carbon sink, which is to say it filters the air. So it's not just a protein and sustenance issue for humans. It's also global stability, climate change issue as well.
Where is the overfishing for fish meal most prevalent?
Africa, and specifically West Africa, is kind of the tip of the spear here when it comes to places in the planet where there's still a robust nearshore fish stocks that attracts the attention of huge foreign industrial commercial boats.
And a great, great many of those boats and factories are Chinese owned.
China is the big player. And Senegal, Mauritania, the Gambia, for example, are being combed for this very market. So in the last decade, 14 factories have been built in those three countries alone just to produce fish meal. And hundreds upon hundreds of large boats are in those coastal waters, scooping up fish that for centuries have been the main source of protein for local survival. The bonga fish, for example, in Gambia was so plentiful and essential that when you went to the market in Gambia, you would get bonga for free as you bought other types of fish. Now the bonga is hard to get, it's extremely expensive, and most of it that's caught is going into the fishmeal plants to be ground up and exported for aquaculture farms so that these foreign countries can feed cod or salmon or shrimp that then get resold to more expensive clients in the developed West. And to make the irony even darker, those Gambians that are now priced out of getting their own bonga are instead importing chicken from countries like China that are extracting the fish that they could be getting from their own waters.
I know that in your very intrepid reporting in West Africa, you found horrific labor conditions on the boats themselves. Give us some background.
On the boats that we boarded, these were Chinese boats in Gambian waters. They typically had a couple Chinese officers, and then the rest were African crew. And most of the crew were not actually Gambians. They were Senegalese because they're cheaper. And then the living conditions and working conditions on these boats generally are brutal. 20-hour work days and really unsafe sleeping conditions and no medicine if you get sick and not proper gear. So these guys are working in flip-flops or barefoot using dangerous equipment, etc. And so on this Earth Day, think about the people and the marine life that are beyond the horizon. And educate yourself about what's happening to them, because what's happening at sea above and below the waterline matters a lot.
That was Ian Urbina, founder of the Outlaw Ocean Project. He was speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer Mukbilia Baro and our managing editor Kate Pound Dawson, thank you for listening and for choosing The Voice.